The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And can this volume loud enough? People hear adequately? It's always a strange question. Because the people who need to answer can't hear. Okay. So to introduce the topic for today, I'd like to read a story. It's from my book called The Monastery Within. And this title of the story is Inside Out. An engineer had been a regular and devoted visitor to the monastery for many years. The meditation practice taught at the monastery was the only thing that made sense to him. In fact, the pragmatic logic of the meditation teachings gave him hope that he would overcome his chronic unhappiness and deeply felt pain. He tried all the meditation practices that the abbess taught him. He began each practice technique with enthusiasm, only to have each end with the same frustration. He would encounter a wall he couldn't pass. The closer he came to the wall, the more he would recoil back into trying to think his way out of his pain. Offering him much support, the abbess encouraged him to relax, trust the practice, and simply feel his inner pain without reacting to it. After many years, the abbess decided a different approach was needed. During his next visit to the monastery, the abbess told him that if he wanted to continue being her student and to be able to return to the monastery, he would have to take on a special practice. Once he had completed the assignment, he could then return for deeper teachings. Once more, feeling hope, the engineer quickly agreed. The abbess said, "For 2 years, I want you to volunteer 10 hours a week at a maternity ward at the local hospital. The hospital needs people to hold babies who are born prematurely. If they don't receive enough physical contact, the babies will not grow healthily. When you have finished these 2 years, please come back to see me." The man was quite perplexed by this instruction, but because of his trust in the abbess and his failure to find any relief elsewhere, he plunged into volunteering in the maternity ward. He was surprised at how small and fragile the babies were that he held. He would hold them ever so carefully. He would watch their every breath because they all seemed in danger of stopping to breathe. He spent a lot of time thinking about how he could more effectively care for the babies he held. But there was nothing more effective than simply holding them against his chest. After 6 months, he started feeling something quite new. He started to feel a little spot of warmth and softness in the very center of his being. Since this was a foreign experience that didn't fit into any of the ways he thought about himself, he ignored it. Ignoring it was the best thing he could have done, because it prevented him from interfering with the warmth by thinking about it too much. Over the following months, this tender spot grew until it pervaded his whole body. As it did, the cold, dark wall around his heart slowly relaxed, thawed, and dissolved. When he had completed his 2 years of volunteering in the maternity ward, the engineer returned to the monastery. The abbess saw immediately that he was a changed man. He was no longer desperate, and he was no longer trying to fit everything he experienced into a conceptual framework. Now he wanted to learn what else the abbess had to teach. Giving him a new instruction, the abbess said to him, "When you meditate, don't think about what is happening. Rather, let your awareness be seated in the tender warmth you feel in your body. If you do this, any meditation practice you do will be fruitful." The man found this to be true. So I think it's a story of someone who's trying too hard, someone who is trying to think his way or through his pain or his challenges, someone who's trying to use techniques as if there's some wonderful engineered practice you can do and follow certain steps and A, B, C and take care of your life and your problems. And the more he did that, the less it worked. And so at some point the abbess felt it was hopeless for him to follow the usual route and sent him to do something that would have an effect on him that he couldn't engineer, that he couldn't cause him to change. She put him in a situation where the conditions allowed something inside of him to shift. So rather than him causing his healing, causing something to shift, he was placed in a situation where the situation provided certain kind of conditioning, certain kind of effect on him that caused, or the situation allowed for something to shift and change inside. So the difference between having a cause and having a condition. So this difference between causing spiritual practice to grow versus creating the conditions for it to grow is at the heart of the Buddha's teachings. And I don't know anywhere where the Buddha assigned someone to hold babies, but I wrote this story after someone told me that he had done this. He had volunteered in the maternity ward to hold preemies, and he did it for some number of years, and how much it changed him to do that. So we have our suffering, and Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on the importance of addressing the suffering we have. And the word suffering is kind of a big word. Some people, it's too big of a word to use because they associate the word suffering with, you know, the biggest catastrophes of life. And the Buddhist word, in Buddhist English, suffering encompasses the whole range from the mildest anxiety you might have. Some people actually translate the word as stress rather than suffering, all the way up to the major forms of human suffering that people have. And then Buddhism is trying to address it. And what Buddhism recognizes is that if you encounter suffering, there is a fork in the road for you. And you can go in two different directions. One is that you can ignore it. You could just kind of recoil from it or ignore it or focus on other things rather than the suffering. And the other is you can turn towards it. And what these ancient teachings of the Buddha says is that if you ignore it, ignore the impact it has on you, that you're liable to make choices, or you're liable to set in place the conditions for further suffering. And the way that that is talked about it as a loop, the suffering loop. If you practice ignoring, turning away from that which is difficult for us, then it has the conditions of us not really being attentive to what drives us, what impulses we have, what intentions we have, motivations we have. If we don't really understand those, then our intentions, motivations color how we see the world, color how we see ourselves. If we have a colored view of the world, then how we meet the world is going to be complicated more than it needs to be. And the desires we have in relationship to the world could be unhealthy and can give birth to strong cravings and clingings, the kind of cravings and clingings that can lead to further suffering. And so they talk about this loop, the suffering loop. And they actually give 12 different pieces of that loop. It goes around and around. But one of the things that's very interesting about this suffering loop is nowhere does it talk about the cause of suffering. It doesn't talk about an agent, a person, who causes suffering. It doesn't talk about someone who's experiencing suffering. So the usual categories in which we approach our experience is not the categories the Buddha uses to look at and be present for our suffering. It's a kind of a radical shift of attention. But rather than looking at a cause, the Buddha looks at the conditions for the existence of suffering. So maybe that's not so interesting, but if you take the other route, the route to liberation, to awakening, freedom from suffering, then instead of ignoring our life, ignoring what's going on, ignoring the suffering, one moves in the direction of understanding, of seeing clearly. But it's not a one-step process to understand. And just as there are 12 steps in the suffering loop, the Buddha gave 12 steps in the liberation. It's not a loop anymore, because you get liberated, you don't loop back into further suffering. But it's more like a spiral that goes up and up. And it's more or less in the middle of those 12 factors that the Buddha talks about having insight and seeing. So in between turning towards suffering and having understanding, overcoming ignorance, there's a series of conditions. And the job of practice is to encourage or set in place those conditions that have an effect on us, just like the holding the babies affected the engineer in the story. So I'll try to explain what these conditions are and how it works, and whether you understand it completely or not, maybe it's less important than if you understand that part of what we're doing in practice is allowing ourselves to be affected by wholesome and skillful things that has a softening or opening or awakening effect on us. And so it's not a linear path. It's also conditional path. It's not a causal path. The responsibility of Buddhist practitioners is to put in place certain conditions and then trust and allow those conditions to have their effect, as opposed to be the one who's responsible for making the change. And many people come to Buddhist practice and think, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm capable, I did well in school, I can do things, you know. And they think this is just one more task that we have to accomplish. And many people have crashed and burned being task-oriented, like, I'm going to do this. And so the alternative is not to be negligent. Still, Buddhist practitioners are diligent in practice, But it's diligent in putting in place the conditions that allows this kind of natural process to unfold. And the word that the Buddha used is, in fact, a natural process. So one analogy or simile he gave for this natural process I find very humorous or cute and also very significant. He said that if a chicken sits on her eggs properly, so the eggs, you know, incubate, she could sit there and have the very strong intention that these eggs should not hatch. And no matter how much she wants them not to hatch, they will hatch. It's natural for well-incubated eggs to hatch. That's what the Buddha said. In the same way, he said, if a practitioner puts in place all the conditions for liberation, even if the practitioner doesn't want to be liberated, the person will get liberated. we're chickens. So this idea of a natural process that unfolds and how to support that natural process is a very important part of this practice. So the idea is to turn towards suffering. But the first step, the first condition, is to turn towards it with confidence or faith or some kind of trust, depending how you want to translate the word, that ancient word. I like the word confidence. But confidence is a great word, and it avoids some of the challenges that some people have with the word faith. But I like faith because faith, for me, it belongs more to the heart. It's more of a heartfeltness in relationship to our life. Whereas confidence is a little bit, I don't know what to say, it's a wonderful quality, but confidence somehow doesn't automatically, for me, suggest the heartfulness that faith does, the sense of devotion or warmth. And the faith is a faith from knowing that there is a path to follow that leads to liberation from suffering, that we're not stuck in the world of suffering. It might be complicated, it might be impenetrable, we might not understand it, we might not know what to do, but in fact there is a path to follow, and so to have faith in the possibility of liberation or freedom from our suffering is the first condition to put in place. How do we get this faith? How do we get this confidence? Maybe for each person, they have to find it for themselves. Sometimes it's borrowed confidence. We meet someone that inspires us, who's done the practice. We say, oh, if that person can do it, maybe I can do it too. This works. Or we read the teachings or hear the teachings, and they just make a lot of sense, and we have a sense of confidence or faith in them. Or that maybe part of the confidence is the confidence that if those people can do it, I can do it. If that's where it heads, I believe in this. But some kind of faith or confidence, some kind of trusting in a process. And that means that when they're suffering, we're not the victim of the suffering. It doesn't mean that we're focusing on how difficult it is. We're actually beginning to crack open a little bit the idea that, yes, there is another way. And then to have confidence and faith in that. That's the condition, the first condition to put in place. And it's a big task. And for some people, it can take years. I've noticed some people, it seems that for a number of years that they come around Buddhist practice places or the Buddhist practice and teachings, they have so much mistrust, so much lack of faith. They've been so betrayed by religions or all kinds of things in their lives that they're just kind of sitting, testing the waters, kind of looking and says, can I trust these people? Can I trust this place? Can I trust these teachings? Is this okay here? And they're just kind of hanging back or maybe not hanging back, but participating. But really what's happening is they're developing and evoking a certain kind of faith. And in some Buddhist circles, they actively promote the cultivation of faith. They do a lot of chanting, they do a lot of bowing. There's a lot of devotional practices that go along with it. And in our insight meditation tradition, you know, we don't do a lot of that devotional things. Sometimes when people ask the teachers, where's the devotion in Vipassana? And we'll say something cute like, oh, it's paying attention to the moment. Well, you know. You know, well, okay. So that's nice. But it takes a little bit longer sometimes to develop the faith. But when the faith comes, hopefully it's on a good foundation. Sometimes when there's too much devotional practices in a tradition, sometimes the devotion can be kind of blind. But anyway, it's part of this the faith, the confidence, the trust to develop that. At this point, that's a condition that gives rise to the next factor. So faith is something we kind of call upon, develop, spend time cultivating. At some point, that faith is strong enough, that confidence is strong enough, that we're glad we have it. There's a gladness to knowing that there's a path to freedom. We have confidence in it, and we're glad we're connected to it. So the Buddha talked about there being arising gladness. Kind of an understanding, this is good. This is a good direction to be on. I'm glad I'm connected to it. With gladness, then, it's possible for the person to be more inspired to engage in the practice. The practice perhaps to be mindful or to be concentrated or practice loving kindness or compassion. To do the practices for sure. But the engagement with the practice when we have faith and gladness supports the arising of joy. As joy arises, there's a kind of sense of reassurance, a sense of satisfaction, a sense of this works, this is nice, this is good. And so then there can happen a relaxing can occur. So the Buddha said that with gladness as a condition, relaxation happens. People begin to relax. When there's a deeper relaxation and continued engagement in the practice, then that engagement shifts from being joyful to a deeper contentment, a deeper kind of, the word is maybe happiness or a deeper ease, a kind of a deeper settled embodied sense of contentment, warmth. Some people call it sublime. With that happiness as a condition, there arises concentration or stability of mind or settledness of mind or greater capacity to really be undistracted, and being undistracted to really focus clearly on what it is we're paying attention to. With that stability of mind, concentration as a condition, at that point, the practitioner understands. At that point, there's insight. And the language that the Buddha used was, one sees things as they are. So it's interesting, this process is... So one does the practice. You have your job to do as a practitioner. You can't just sit on the couch and wait. You do your job, but it isn't that the practice you do is the cause for the change. There are other conditions that come into play as we practice, and those conditions are what stimulate or catalyst for the change, the growth that we have. So we have our responsibility, but we don't cause the change. And so doing the practice, not looking for the practice to do the thing, the practice is allowing the conditions to work through us. And so this idea of this having a foundation for these wonderful qualities, a foundation of faith or confidence, gladness, joy, tranquility, and happiness and concentration, all those kind of grow and develop. And with that as the environment, with that as the kind of condition in place, then it's possible to begin penetrating into the nature of suffering in a deep way. Because many times this most serious, difficult suffering that people have, the most deepest attachments we have, can seem quite impenetrable, quite difficult to face and deal with, understand. But the idea is we prepare ourselves in order to do that. And this is the bad news for people who want to do things efficiently. You know, it's nice to be able to, this Buddhism stuff is good stuff, but it's nice to get it over with so we can do there's a lot of other things to do. and so you'd like to kind of do the efficient approach to practice 1, 2, 3 and be done with it and move on. That would be nice. There was a very touching story many years ago, the Dalai Lama. I wasn't there, but I've heard about it from people who were there. I think it was in Phoenix, large auditorium of people, and he was giving some teaching. And then there was a period of questions and answers. And the person stood up and said something like, what's the quickest way to enlightenment? As the story was told to me, the Dalai Lama was silent for a long time. He stood there for a very long time. And at some point he started to cry. And then he said something about, I can't characterize it probably accurately, but as I kind of think I remember it, he said something like, how sad it is to have this kind of greed or be in a hurry to try to get enlightened. That's not quite what it's about. That's kind of almost like counterproductive. It's not meant to be the most efficient process, this whole is. Because the very idea of being efficient and quick generally comes from an egotistical point of view. Me, myself, and mine. And that whole idea of me, myself, and mine is put aside in the Buddha's description of the path of practice. All these conditions that occur, the development of these conditions, the growing, the flowering of these conditions, are not discussed in any way at all in language of me, myself, and I. There's no self-reference in these things. It's almost like it's a natural process that evolves independent of the self-reference that so many of us are caught in. So to spend time tending, like you would tend to a garden perhaps, tending to yourself, so you put together these great conditions. We have tremendous capacity, these hearts of ours, to grow gardens of beautiful states, beautiful qualities. And what does it take? What are the conditions you have to do for that? This is one of the reasons why Buddhism emphasizes practices of ethics, living by the precepts, because those are wonderful conditions. Not living ethically creates the conditions for unease, creates the conditions that are not going to give birth, create the ground for the flowering of beautiful qualities. It's one of the reasons why Buddhism emphasizes generosity, because generosity is a condition for the flowering of something beautiful inside. If we allow for that flowering, if we do generosity as an obligation, or selfishly, that creates a very different condition than doing it generosity generously and a lot coming from the warmth of the heart or the openness of the heart or some place inside that's kind of has some purity to it, maybe. This is why Buddhism emphasizes things like loving kindness and compassion, because those also create kind of a good soil in the heart for things, these conditions to grow and develop. And so the conditions of confidence or faith. Some people struggle with the concept of faith and resist it. And some people like this Vipassana teaching or Buddhism because it can seem so rational. And if you have the good fortune or the bad fortune of listening to a person like me who's so, you know, rational and demythologizes everything, I don't know if it helps or hinders. But to see what can you do to help support faith, confidence, in such a way that the confidence you have in a practice, in certain teachings, in yourself, allows a little spot of warmth to grow in your heart, of gladness, of contentment, of satisfaction, of rightness or inspiration or joy or delight. I don't know, you know, different, all these words, different people have different ways in, but it allows something to grow. Certainly we have a lot of suffering, and I'm not trying to say that we override the suffering. Remember, this is a path of not ignoring suffering, it's turning towards it. We turn towards it with our faith that there is a way. And with a faith that gives us a certain kind of gladness or joy in spite of the fact that we're suffering. So we're not weighed down by the suffering. The suffering is actually the soil for these beautiful qualities to grow, to sprout. One of the teachings in Buddhism is that it's a claim, I don't know if it's universal, but no one comes to Buddhism without suffering first. So that's a very tender thing to say, because look at all of us here. You know, who are we and what brings us here? And we have this in common, the suffering we're trying to address, the stress, the unease, something. It's quite something the tradition says that suffering is a condition, can be a condition for moving in a healthy direction. So suffering is not just a drag. It can be if we ignore it or react to it in unhealthy ways. But explicitly in the Buddhist tradition, suffering is the soil or the condition that can give birth to these other qualities. And you can't have faith in a practice to the liberation of suffering unless you suffer. That's just, you know, like, that's the bad news. So it kind of goes together. So then with the faith or confidence, gladness, with enough gladness as you do the practice, joy. With enough joy as you do the practice, tranquility. With enough relaxation as you do the practice, happiness. With enough happiness as you do the practice, concentration. With enough concentration that you have in the practice, then there's insight. Then they're seeing what's going on. Then he goes on from there, and Buddha says, in seeing what's going on, then there's further unfolding. And now the next one is a process of disenchantment, or starting to lose interest in that way that our mind operates that holds the suffering in place. And as we lose interest, then our clinging and our craving, our resistance, begins to fade. And when it fades enough, it gets weak enough, thin enough, then at that point, that's a condition that something inside lets go. There's a deep letting go. There's liberation. So this whole path to liberation that the Buddha offers in this particular teaching is all based on conditions. Certain conditions are in place. It's natural that something else will arise from that. Kind of remarkable. So I offer that to you today with the suggestion, or with hopefully the inspiration, that maybe you can cultivate your good heart. Maybe you can spend time looking at what are the conditions you can put together in your life so that what's the potentials you have in your heart for these beautiful qualities, that they might grow and develop. You can't make them grow, but you can have the conditions for it. But it does require something from you. and it might require a lot from you. This is not a path for the lazy. It's not the path for those who want to do it just once in a great while. Because you can't boil water by turning the flame on and off all the time. You have to kind of make this a priority, enough priority, that there's enough momentum going. There's enough sunlight on the plants, so the sunlight that the plants have a chance to grow. And how much sunlight, how much time you give yourself to this, and how you integrate it into your life, is going to be very different from every single person. But it does require some engagement, some involvement. It's not wishful thinking. So if the hen really wants those eggs to hatch, but decides that she's sat on those eggs long enough, she's going to go to spend some time out in the field, like a few weeks, or, you know, where the bugs are good, then it's natural for those eggs not to hatch. So if you want to develop the path of practice in Buddhism, keep sitting on your eggs. You know, cultivate, support, nourish the conditions. Nourish the goodness in your heart. Nourish these wonderful things. Nourish faith, confidence. Nourish gladness, joy, happiness, tranquility. And nourish the capacity to be concentrated and stability of heart. And then, when all that is in place at some point, you'll see clearly. So we have about 5 minutes. And if you have any questions you'd like to ask about that or comments, you're quite welcome.
Thanks, Jim. Toward the beginning, toward the beginning of your talk, you mentioned a spiral, and I wondered if you'd say a little bit more about how the conditions might work in a spiral, or is there a way that they repeat, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a kind of a diagram kind of a, for this, because the suffering loop is always a circle. It goes around and around. And sometimes when they diagram the liberation steps, it's just like an arc that just leaves the circle, just goes off. But some people like to think of it as a spiral, because the path to liberation, it kind of loops back on itself over and over again. So as we practice along, we have a little bit of faith at first, maybe just a little smudgeon of faith, confidence, and then we engage in the practice, and we find a little bit of benefit from it, some appreciation of that. We don't even call it joy at this point, just appreciation, relief. But that relief helps us to kind of be more focused. And we start seeing little pieces of ways in which we add to our suffering and wonder what's going on. And then once we see that, that inspires us. It gives us more faith. And we have more faith, then we kind of continue. And it's not a circle, because each time it gets stronger and better. It's further and further up into that. Usually these diagrams go up. And so that goes round and around and around.
I'd like to go back to the quickest way to enlightenment, which was an egocentric approach.
Yes.
But then the process, as you described, we go to gladness, we go to happiness, we go to joy, serenity. Each one of those, as far as I can see, is an egocentric reward. So,
But then you have to define egocentric for me.
Meaning that those would be, in themselves, rewards for me, the I, me, myself. Each step of those would be a reward. And so then the difference between the person who wanted the quickest way to enlightenment and those who were following this path of each one saying, hey, this is pretty good. This is, and then go to the next step, and this is pretty good for me. One has patience, one doesn't, but each of them are seeking the next step, which is a personal reward.
Yeah, I think if you're being mindful enough, mindfulness is self-correcting, corrects for that. Because if it's egocentric, you know, if you're doing it for me, myself, and mine, it gets in the way. It kind of puts turns off the light in the greenhouse where the plants are growing. So, for example, I don't know if this is a good example, but if I'm chilled and I go stand in the sun and the warmth of the sun begins, it can feel very pleasant, very enjoyable to feel that warmth. Oh, and I just kind of relax and go, oh, this is so good. This is nice. And certain kind of happiness or gladness can come to have this. That's nice. And then, this is my warmth. Look at me. I'm so good. I'm getting so nice and warm. I'm toasty. This is so great. I bet that they should give me a little badge, a little medal, so I can show people. And I'm really proud of myself and what I'm doing here. And it's like no one else is doing as good as me. It's messing it up. You know, you're not really. Then you kind of left the world of the pleasure, and you're off in some kind of fantasy world of what it's all about. So that's a dramatic example of how we mess it up. So we can approach these things egocentrically, but I think for these conditions to really operate well, the way they're meant to operate, we have to learn how to not mess it up with the conditions of egocentrism. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so in fact, the looping of suffering, those kind of intentions, the desires, the clinging to self, spins the circle faster and faster. So, but each step along the liberation path, it's possible to, for the egocentric self to get involved, and then it might take a little while for the mindfulness practice to help us see how we're suffering with that, and then be able to let it go. And once it's let it go, then the light shines again on the plants. Okay?
Okay.
Great. One more here. You can pass the mic up to the middle of the room. Right up here. All right. It's coming from...
You want to disturb?
Oh, do we? But here with him.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed that. I guess one of the things I'm wondering about is like that point of like what is it actually like to we talked about holding our suffering or about stepping back or about letting go. How to talk about what that experience is
of holding the suffering.
A couple of points of instruction that I heard recently that I felt really helped me were one, to kind of let the meditation object fill your mind, so instead of really focusing
yeah,
on
that's,
it,
that's very
to
nice.
Let it fill my mind.
Uh-huh, very nice.
And the other thing that was mentioned is that, you know, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. We're mindful, we develop concentration, and through concentration we become wise. That word concentration was actually a mistranslation, and that the Pali word actually means tranquility. I don't know if that's true.
No, there's two words that are sound very similar. Mm. There's samadhi and samatha. Mm. And samatha means tranquility. Mm. Samadhi is closer to our word concentration than it is to tranquility. Mm-hmm. But they're closely related. Mm-hmm. So when people talk about having samatha practice, What they're talking about is doing samadhi practice, mm-hmm. or cultivating samadhi. Mm-hmm. So, because deep concentration requires comes with a lot of tranquility.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, yeah, could you expound on that a little bit in terms of that mental state? Like, is it this kind of laser-like focus, or is it something where it's more open and when we let go, is that like a thing that we do, or is it more like something arises and we just don't participate in what perpetuates it?
I think it's useful to think of samadhi as a state rather than as an activity. So it's a whole state of being that we enter into, and it's something that includes all of us. Often it's talked about a unification of the mind and heart, a collecting of all our faculties so they're operating together. I like to sometimes translate it as composure, because of the sam part of samadhi means with, like the calm of composure, and the d part of samadhi means to stand or to pose, so compose. And the idea of composure is something that's holistic. It's all, when you say compose yourself, some people would just kind of like take a deep breath, sit up straight, and kind of relax and settle in and be kind of grounded here. And so this kind of unified totality. And within that, we become centered on something. So it can be a very sharp, penetrating focus that some people might call a laser-like focus. But the laser-like focus is a byproduct of this settling and unification that goes on. And people who try to use a laser-like focus first, before that composure is set in, will get a headache.
Thank you.
Okay. So if you understood this talk, that's wonderful. If you didn't understand this talk, then I'd like to summarize it with a very brief statement. All of you have very good hearts, whether you know it or not. Thank you.